1042 CR, State v. Tejano, representing the Attorney General's Office, and Assistant Attorney General Sarah Larson. Ms. Larson.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Sarah Larson, representing the State, and if I would, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
No problem.
Thank you. State wants this court to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and reinstate Tejano's conviction because the Court of Appeals applies improper evidentiary standards at three different points in the Sullivan analysis. First, the Court of Appeals erred by holding that the evidence was not relevant because it did not conclusively prove the ultimate fact of Tejano's knowledge, rather than determining whether the evidence had any tendency to make facts in a chain or intermediate inferences about those facts more or less probable than without the evidence. I will lead this court in discussing the links in the inferential chains, which show that the other X evidence was relevant to motive because it made it more likely than without the evidence that he shot because he needed to hide the drugs. I will also show the links in the inferential chains that show that it was relevant to context, the context within which he invoked self-defense, because it made it more likely than without the evidence that he heard them say police during the execution of a search warrant. Second, I will discuss why the Court of Appeals erred by holding the evidence was prejudicial merely because it undermined his defense, rather than assessing the evidence's potential danger to lead the jury to a prohibited propensity inference. In other words, because he did prior act X, he was of bad character and therefore necessarily committed the present act Y. Third and finally, I will discuss why the Court of Appeals erred in their harmless and error analysis by improperly comparing the two trials rather than assessing the overwhelming untainted evidence in the second trial, which showed that he was not acting in self-defense. Turning to my first point, relevance, I just wanted to point out a few general principles about relevance. Under the relevance statute, it's a very low standard. Does the evidence have any tendency to make the proposition more or less probable than without the evidence? I think the main analytical flaw in the Court of Appeals opinion is that they were saying that the evidence needed to conclusively prove his ultimate fact of his knowledge, or make it more likely than a different proposition, or make it more likely than not. But that's not the standard. It's only whether it has any tendency to make a proposition more or less probable than without the evidence.
Okay, now the inference you draw, that the state wants drawn, is
yes,
that because he has drugs, right, and a gun, he would know that the people in the at the door, breaking down the door, would be cops, right?
And the ultimate inference of his knowledge, but knowledge is not subject to direct perception, and it's pretty hard to prove.
You tell me, what is the consequential fact that this relates to? Relevance is a two-step process. You go through the two steps, and then tell. Then we'll deal with relevance, right?
Okay. Well, first I'll talk about, do you want me to discuss why we think it's relevant to motive and context?
Well, I want you to tell me whether it's relevant to anything.
Okay.
You have two arguments, if I understand your brief, that it's relevant to self-defense, which is knowledge and motive, and you have a second argument that it's relevant to context.
Right.
Right?
Right. I think within the first argument, it's a little more broad than that because all of the state of mind purposes under the statute kind of blend into each other. So we're talking about rebutting his self-defense, but we're also basically talking about his motive. Why did he shoot? Was it self-defense? Or was it something else?
It boils down to self-defense.
Correct. And without the evidence, as in the first trial, the jury had no reason to believe that he had any drugs to hide because there was no drugs found in the search warrant. And that was a major part of his defense in the first trial that he had no other motive. So the state needed to have this evidence to rebut that inference. And so with the evidence, it made it more probable than without the evidence that he even had any drugs to hide.
The evidence that he has drugs leads to two inferences. Mm-hmm. One, that he's going he might expect cops and he's going to be afraid of them and do something. The other inference is that there are criminal elements out there that know he has drugs, or customers who know he has drugs, that's a third inference, and that the thugs are going to want the drugs and or the money from the drugs, right? Or his customers who now are short money are going to want that. So you've got at least three reasonable inferences. So why does the fact that he has drugs make it more probable than not that he thinks it's cops? Those three inferences seem to be equal to me.
Well, it doesn't have to make it more probable than
what
not.
What does it have to do?
It has to make it more probable than without the evidence, which I see as a little bit different. And your point is exactly that if it goes to competing inferences, it doesn't render it irrelevant. It just makes it for the jury to decide. And I think that's exactly what they had to do in this case. They had to decide which of these inferences to believe, whether it was self-defense or thugs, or that he was shot to buy the time. But that doesn't render the evidence irrelevant. That's the error in the Court of Appeals opinion in this case.
And that's the error that the Court of Appeals made in your opinion.
In my opinion, it is, because with the evidence, it makes it more probable that he had the drugs. So it undermines his innocent explanation that he had no reason to hide the drugs because he had no drugs. It also makes it more likely than without the evidence the state's sort of spoliation theory that he destroyed the evidence, and that was relevant to rebut the inference from the first trial from the state's failure to produce any drugs in the search warrant.
How does that fit with your argument that it's harmless error? On the one hand, you say, oh, this is very important because we needed it, otherwise we're going to get a hung jury. And then at the back end of your brief, you say, oh, harmless error, harmless error, harmless error. They would have convicted anyway.
Right, well, I think the Court of Appeals erred, and I can discuss that right now if you'd like, in talking about the comparison of the two trials. I was not able to come up with a case during briefing that discusses this, but I did find a case before the argument discussing this issue of mistrial and then later trial. And there was a case that's cited in the Blanket Treatise called Hereford, and it's 195 Westlaw 2nd 1054. That's a Court of Appeals opinion from 1995. And that had... it was Hereford, 195 Westlaw 2nd 1054.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Yes. And in that case, there was a mistrial in the first trial and a hung jury, same thing here, because the circuit court had admitted investigator reports, which later they determined was in error. But there was a hung jury, and the Court of Appeals said, because there was a hung jury, we cannot assume anything about why he wasn't convicted the first time, but he was the second time. Lots of reasons, myriad reasons why that could have been. And that's a dangerous road for this court to go down. If you hold that you can compare two trials, what's to say you can't compare two defendants or two similar charges when you're talking about harmless error? The standard is it harmless in light of the untainted evidence at the same trial? Was there sufficient evidence other than or uninfluenced by the other act's evidence to convict the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt? And in this case, we're arguing that, assuming that it was an error to admit the evidence, it was harmless because the jury had all of this information that he knew they were police at the door, and I can discuss that in a moment, and that he acted inconsistently with self-defense by failing to say that it was in self-defense in his statement. He denied the shooting initially, but he never said it was in self-defense at all.
Counsel, may I just ask, in the first trial, or even in the second trial, did the jury know why these police were banging down this man's door?
Well, my understanding of the record is that they didn't, and that was one of the reasons why, because the execution of the search warrant was a large issue in the first trial. And so the circuit court wanted to correct that misimpression in the second trial by admitting the evidence for context, insofar as it shed light as to how they executed the search warrant and why.
It's somewhat of a catch-22, it seems to me, because on one hand, the jury is going to think about, gee, you know, that's unacceptable behavior for someone to come bang down my door, mm-hmm. right? And unless the jury's told, well, there was a legitimate reason for them to be there, then that's going to be something that might be a pervasive theme throughout the trial and distract them from the real issue and the focus of reckless endangerment or whatever the issue was here. So it strikes me that your context and background and just putting the jury in a place as to why the police would be there is a fairly strong argument, unless, of course, the defendant were to stipulate that there was a legitimate reason for these people to be there. But my guess is he didn't. And the reason why I'm saying that is you look to self-defense, and one of the issues is that the defendant believed there was an actual or imminent unlawful interference with this person, and it goes to the defendant's belief all through the issue of self-defense. So you have to take a look at how's the state going to deal with that issue. Mm-hmm. And the burden is on the state, and that's something that to me is important here as to why context and background is an issue, because the state is the one who has to prove by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act lawfully in self-defense. You can't just let the evidence come in and have someone say, oh, gee, you know, I thought someone was breaking down my door, no legitimate reason for doing so, and then, you know, expect to meet your burden of proof, which is beyond a reasonable doubt to rebut that self-defense. So can you explain to me the context of what the jury knew when you were trying this case either time?
Well, I didn't try the case, so I can't speak to that.
State.
My understanding was that the first trial, they didn't have very much information at all about why they were executing the search warrant.
Well, did they know that, did the jury know there was a search warrant?
I think they did know it was a search warrant, but I don't think that juries can understand necessarily the distinctions between the types of search warrants, and that's actually part of the reason why it was so important for the evidence to come in the second time around.
It was a no-knock warrant?
It was a no-knock warrant.
But why did the police then announce that they were there?
Well, under the MPD policy, I understand that they just announce no matter what, even though it's not required under the no-knock warrant standards.
So then the no-knock was not relevant?
Well, it was relevant because they were not intending on doing it that way. They were intending on doing a knock and announce, but they actually had authority for the no-knock.
Yeah, but did they? Okay. And then so they announced and then they used the sledgehammer, is that right?
So they ended up doing the no-knock because the suspect fled in the street when he saw the police. It ended up not being the defendant, it was his cousin. But then when they went to his door and they pounded down the door with the sledgehammer.
Didn't they say they announced that this is the police?
They did. They all were yelling and screaming, police, police, in Spanish and in English, manos arriba, whatever, search warrant. All of those things were yelling and screaming, and there was testimony that...
So if the defendant heard it, could he have thought that people were calling the police?
Well, he testified at trial that he didn't know they were police, but in his statement, he admitted that he heard them say police.
He had two inconsistent statements then.
Correct.
That was brought in for the jury?
Yes. And I think that's a central issue to the trial, whether the police were loudly announcing or fairly announcing, because he claimed that he didn't hear them say police, and they were lying, and they never said anything, and they were macho and reckless, and they just came and busted down my door, and I didn't know who they were. That was his story, but the state's story was, no, wait a minute, you put self-defense at issue, so it makes it relevant for us to rebut your contention, because it shows the context within which the search warrant was executed, and also the context within which the self-defense defense was asserted. So in other words, his self-defense depended entirely on what the circumstances were at the door. Did they or did they not fairly announce? Did they say police? Were they wearing clothes indicating they were police? And they were bulletproof vests.
One of the questions that I have is, since we're dealing with other acts evidence, did the trial court, and I'm focusing on the second trial, did the trial court give a cautionary instruction? And if so, what did the trial court say in regard to the reasons that this evidence was being allowed?
I was unable to find a jury instruction. I don't think one was given. All they had was the admonitions from the parties that this case is not about...
Admonition from the circuit court to the parties.
In the Sullivan hearing, they did talk about that, but I thought you were asking about the jury.
Yes.
I am.
You just misstated that the court, you tried to say, I think, that the court admonished the lawyers not to, and then you can finish.
Right. The court said, no, you're not allowed to talk about that he was dealing drugs. You're not allowed to say that at all. All you're allowed to do is have the confidential informant testify about what he saw in the kitchen, that he was packaging up cocaine and had a gun nearby. But that was the testimony of the confidential informant.
Okay, but now that the court allows other acts evidence, and you're telling me that the justification for that was context and apparently self-defense. And as I understand what you're saying that the circuit judge never gave a cautionary instruction to the jury in regard to the other acts evidence?
That's what I'm saying. There was no cautionary instruction to the jury.
And look at Petitioner Appendix 125, which is the judge, the court. Is that the Sullivan?
This is the Sullivan.
Okay, and at the last paragraph, the judge says, I do think the context and testimony of this witness is something that the jury should hear for a very narrow point. And I certainly will instruct the jury that they are to consider this only on the issue of whether or not Mr. Payano reasonably believed that it was armed thugs that were attacking his door. And who did what, with some narrow exceptions, aren't going to be the primary focus of this trial in not a material dispute. And you're saying she did not give that instruction.
I'm saying that, to my knowledge, no one gave the cautionary instruction to the jury. There was a jury instructions conference. They discussed other instructions, but they never talked about that.
Are the jury instructions in the record?
Yeah.
Okay. Did the defendant request a cautionary instruction?
No, he did not.
Thank you.
Neither party objected to or made arguments regarding the failure to give a jury instruction at the end, right?
No, they did not.
But there also was not a jury instruction given at the time the informant testified. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay.
That's my reading of the record, yeah. And I don't know why. I can speculate, but about why they didn't bring it up. But nobody brought it up, and the defendant never requested the instruction.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to the beginning. You started out making your three points that the Court of Appeals erred. In number one, you think that they erred when they said that the evidence was not relevant. Are you asking us as a matter of law to determine that the evidence is relevant?
I'm asking you to hold that the circuit court did not erroneously exercise the discretion in holding that it was relevant.
Okay, let's get to that issue then, because there's some discussion regarding your brief on page 13 and 14 and 15 regarding de novo, which I interpret to mean as a matter of law. It's not the exact interpretation, but I substitute as a matter of law for that. Mm-hmm. And I look particularly at the quote that you have on page 15 of your brief of Jeske, which you cite with approval and relative length in your brief.
Right.
And Jeske talks about the discretion of the trial court, and in essence, it says looking at the top of 15, that the discretion will be sustained if it's a reason, there's a rational approach, and it is sub A, one a reasonable judge could reach. In other words, you don't want something over the deep end that no reasonable person could reach. And two, that it's consistent with applicable law, right? So in order to determine whether or not exercise of discretion should be upheld, you have to see if the rational exposition of it on the record is one that a reasonable judge could make, objectively reasonable judge could make, and two, whether that was consistent with the applicable law. Isn't that process, doesn't that then require an appellate court to look at the demonstrated exercise of discretion to see if it is consistent with law as a matter of law?
Plus, if you look at it that way, then...
That's the way I look at it, because I think that's the way that Jeske also looks at it. That although, and then Jeske goes on to say, very importantly, right after the A and B that I just quoted, we will affirm the decision even if it's not one with which we ourselves would agree with. So, you know, we're just not talking about substituting judgment here. You know, that's not what we look at. But part of a review of exercise of discretion is, as according to Jeske, it's not over the deep end, it's something a reasonable judge could reach, a conclusion, and that it's consistent, and some of our cases say that it's consistent, it didn't misapply the facts or law. So in other words, there's a legal analysis that's involved in determining whether or not an exercise of discretion will be upheld.
Yes, there is. But I also think that this court's role and the appellate court's role is to not second guess the circuit court's decision. And I think here there was a very reasonable explanation as to why the judge found it relevant.
It seems like you were taking the court to task on pages 13 and 14 of interposing a de novo that is as a matter of law determination. And I say to you, I think that in our jurisprudence, it's inherent with it, just exactly the way that Jeske sets it out. Do you agree with me or disagree? Or you want to reserve ruling?
Huh? Well, I guess I don't disagree, but I just think that the exercise of discretion, it is a discretionary determination, any evidentiary analysis.
Sure, but it's got to be consistent. What if they misapply the facts? Won't uphold that, will you?
Right.
You know, if it's based on a misapplication of understanding of the facts, and if it's based on a misapplication of the law, you won't uphold that either, would you?
No, but in reviewing the exercise of discretion, you do have to look at the law and the facts, as you're saying, and so I guess there is some legal analysis in that. That's what I meant, though, that the Court of Appeals failed to do that because they just superimposed their own idea of what the relevance was. And that's clear if you look at paragraph 24. The Court of Appeals opinion thinks that the state is being conclusory in assuming that the other acts evidence provides insight into his knowledge.
I read it as the Court of Appeals saying, as a matter of law, it's not relevant.
Right, and we're disputing that.
And you're saying as a matter of law, it is relevant. You're saying as to context, it's relevant as to, you know, the state of mind and...
Saying as a matter of law, reasonable people could maybe differ about it, but therefore it's a discretionary determination that you should uphold because it's reasonable under the facts and the law. But it's also important to recognize that the probative value of evidence isn't analyzed.
I just want to pause it for just a second. At the end of it, because you make, your big point is that they did not apply the correct standard of review, which is that relevance is an exercise of discretion. And in paragraph 25, the last sentence, the Court of Appeals' last sentence is, Codice's testimony was not relevant to this determination. And as such, the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion. So I read this to say they used the right standard. You may not be happy with what they said, but they mouthed the right standard and applied, in their opinion, the right standard. Now, you may disagree with them, but I don't think you can say that they used the wrong standard.
I think the point that I was trying to make, though, is that it's clear from the Court of Appeals opinion that they just disagreed about the relevance of the evidence.
They disagreed because at the bottom of 24, they said that Piano's alleged presence of cocaine no more supports the proposition, so it doesn't support the proposition, that he believed the men attempting to break down his door were police. Doesn't it support that? And it doesn't support that Piano believed there were hoodlums. Now, I understand, because I deliberately, when I phrased my first question to you, put it in terms of your brief, rather than in terms of what the fact to be proved is. But they put it in terms of the fact to be proved. They didn't think that it supports the proposition that the men attempted to break down the door with police.
Well, the state would contend that it's actually probably relevant to both propositions, because without the drugs, there'd be no reason for thugs to be at his door either, or police. It doesn't make
there
any sense.
There are thugs all around, even if you don't have.
He said he had no enemies. There were some robberies in his neighborhood, but...
I don't have enemies, and I've been burglarized. And I don't have drugs either.
I see my red light is out. If I may just make...
May summarize quickly. You've got a lot of...
I was just going to say that relevance does not occur in a vacuum. You can't focus exclusively on the challenged evidence. You have to look as to why it's being offered, and here it was being offered to rebut his self-defense contention, and it increases in probative value for that reason, as Professor Blinka in some of the cases discussed that.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Brennan?
Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, my name is Patrick Brennan, and I represent Tony Piano, who, as you know, is the defendant appellant respondent in this case. Having made a fairly perilous journey from Points East this morning, I welcome the opportunity to tell you why it is I believe and why it is you should conclude that the Court of Appeals District 1 opinion rendered April 15, 2008 is a sound one, a legally defensible one, and one which should be affirmed. As this court is aware, this is not a complicated case insofar as what the court is confronted with. In my judgment, this distills down to exclusively one issue, and that issue is simply whether the Court of Appeals' decision reversing Piano's conviction is consistent with this court's holding in the Sullivan decision. And before I embark on explaining to you, hopefully answering any questions you might have along those lines, I would, just as a matter of preface, because I think it might be helpful, pass along to Justice Ziegler and others that I was the trial counsel at the first trial. So insofar as there may be questions directed at that, I am particularly well equipped to answer those. As the panel knows, Sullivan sets forth the three-part other acts evidence test, and the first thing that need be considered is whether the other acts is offered for a statutory permissible purpose. My reading of the Court of Appeals decision is that the Court of Appeals concluded that, yes, the trial court was accurate, yes, the trial court was correct in finding that there was a suitable statutory purpose. And while it's not entirely clear from the Court of Appeals decision, I believe the finding was that it was admissible for context, that it met that statutory requirement. Obviously, then, the court and the trial court and subsequently the Court of Appeals was to determine whether the other acts evidence is relevant. And as this court well knows, having authored Sullivan, that invites a two-part inquiry. One, does the evidence relate to a fact or a proposition that is of consequence to the determination of the action? And two, does the evidence have probative value? That is, does it have any tendency to make the consequential fact or proposition more or less probable than it would be without the evidence? And, I think correctly so, Sullivan places the burden on the proponent of that evidence to demonstrate its relevancy, to answer those two questions. And finally, the third part of the Sullivan test requires this court to consider whether the probative value, assuming it has probative value, is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of the issues, misleading of the jury, considerations of undue delay, waste of time, or needless presentation of cumulative evidence. As this court knows, Piano was charged with three counts emanating out of a single gunshot that occurred October 3rd, 2005. That was tried first in June of 06 to a mistrial, a hung jury, and then subsequently retried and convicted following that retrial of three lesser included offenses. And as we are all well aware, that second trial differed materially from the first trial in that evidence from the informant upon whose information the police secured the no-knock warrant was brought before the jury. And to return to Justice Ziegler's query of the state when the state was making its initial remarks and to clear up any confusion which might attend to that, in the first trial, the jury was informed that this incident occurred during the execution of a no-knock search warrant, and certain limited testimony was allowed in so as to familiarize the jury with what a no-knock search warrant is and was. So the jury was not left to speculate, wonder why it was the police were there at that time, in that manner, in that place. I think the Court of Appeals correctly notes in its decision at page 9 that the state's theory at the second trial was that Piano fired the shot because he needed time to destroy evidence of drugs in the apartment. And Piano's claim was that he fired the one shot to fend off what he reasonably believed to be armed intruders who were both pursuing his cousin, who apparently was hysterical when he ran into the room, and were attempting to break into his home. And the trial record is replete with references to what was going on inside of the apartment whilst the banging on the door was taking place.
Were drugs destroyed? Was there any evidence that drugs were destroyed in this interval?
No, ma'am.
No flushing of the toilets?
Actually, there was the only involvement, so to speak, of a toilet was after the police successfully gained entrance, the firearm that was used was found hidden in a toilet. But as to flushing, rinsing, none of that, no.
No box or no tank for some sort of acid or other equipment that would destroy drugs?
No, Justice Abrams.
Any drugs found?
No drugs found, no indicia of drug dealing, no cash, no packaging materials, no scales, nothing other than the firearm that was recovered from inside of the toilet tank. I'm sorry, Justice Ziegler.
Was there any offer in the second trial to stipulate? We'll stipulate the police were legitimately there to execute a warrant, that they were doing it properly. Was there any offer like that so that this, it would remove the context background, that argument regarding other acts evidence?
I believe the position of the defendant in the second trial was that this evidence, if allowed in, would be both irrelevant and whatever de minimis probative value it might have would be far superseded by its potential for unfair prejudice. So no, I know based on my review of the second trial record that defense counsel vigorously objected to the introduction of any evidence in the form of testimony from the informant.
Sometimes there's that's one line of attack, but then if you're going to let it in, Judge, here, we agree, we'll stipulate. The state was legitimately there, they were executing it appropriately. You know, there's no issue as to setting the stage for the jury as to why they'd be there.
I concur with that. The state argued that Jason Kogis' testimony was offered to provide context and to rebut the theory of self-defense, and that both purposes were acceptable under 904.4.2. And as I've indicated, the Court of Appeals seemed to say that, yes, it was an acceptable purpose. It gave context. This, I think, is the crux of the biscuit, as it were. The Court of Appeals determined that this proffered evidence did not meet the second prong of the Sullivan test. More specifically, the Court of Appeals did not agree that the testimony regarding the presence of cocaine at Payano's apartment the day before supported the inference that Payano would reasonably have known that it was police executing a search warrant at the time that the shot was fired. And I think, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that's the point perhaps you were referring to in your query of the state. And instead, and I think reasonably so, the Court of Appeals agreed with Payano's contention that the presence of cocaine at the residence the day before the shooting, and the quote they used was a quote from our brief before them, no more supports the proposition that he's thus believed the men attempting to break down his door were policemen than the notion that Payano believed they were hoodlums seeking to harm him, his mother, his cousin, and steal the cocaine. And in further articulating its rationale for finding that the second prong of the Sullivan test had not been met, the Court of Appeals states, this case does not center on the police officer's conduct in executing the no-knock warrant and whether that conduct was appropriate. Rather, the issue is whether Payano legitimately believed he was being attacked by non-police officers and fired the shot in self-defense. Kogis' testimony is not relevant to this determination, and as such, the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion in admitting it. And just before I leave this notion of abuse of discretion, I think that in its brief, the state and in its argument, the state has asserted that the Court of Appeals applied a de novo standard here. And with all due respect, I think when you look at the body of the opinion of the Court of Appeals is replete with correct references to what the relevant appellate standard is, which is obviously abuse of discretion. In returning to the Court of Appeals decision, finally, they also did the Court of Appeals, correctly so in my judgment, decide that the third prong of the Sullivan test, that is the relevance versus danger of unfair prejudice standard, was resolved in favor of keeping the evidence out. And in making that determination, I think the Court of Appeals fairly and appropriately foisted the burden of demonstrating the existence of unfair prejudice upon Payano, and I think also correctly found that that burden had been met. The case before the jury was not a drug case. The case before the jury concerned events which happened at a doorway in a heated few moments. And to introduce into that trial and to put before that jury, considering just those charges, evidence that Tony Payano was a drug dealer couldn't possibly have any impact other than to create and to evoke an instinct to condemn and to punish. And that's
Mr. Brennan, let me, if I might interrupt you for a minute.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume that this was error, that the Court of Appeals got it right, that this testimony should not have been allowed in this case. Why doesn't harmless error take care of it?
Because, as I think the Court of Appeals correctly notes in its opinion, the court was incapable of saying with any measure of confidence or conviction that this error did not impact on the outcome of the trial. And I think that in support of that proposition, I don't believe it was inappropriate for the Court of Appeals to at least make reference to the fact that In the absence of this evidence, which they found to be improperly admitted, there was no acquittal, or there was no conviction for
the Now, your opposing counsel cites us to the Hereford case and says, hung jury, you can't assume the reasons for that hung jury, and therefore what the Court of Appeals did here in focusing on that idea of the hung jury was inappropriate. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think it can be the entire focus. I don't think that's necessarily dispositive, but I don't think that it's a factor that cannot be looked at, and I don't think that's what, and I hadn't read that opinion before it was cited today. It hadn't been cited in any briefs, but I don't believe that the state of the law is such that you can't even consider the fact that this evidence wasn't in the first trial, was in the second. I don't think that's where the law stands on that question.
So you would read the Court of Appeals decision as not just looking at the idea of hung jury, but looking at other factors as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that the Court of Appeals appropriately defined the standard, and that is that the state, as the beneficiary of the error, has the burden to establish there is no reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction. And that's State v. Dias that the Court of Appeals correctly cites as their rationale in support of the proposition that harmless error does not save the day on behalf of the state in this instance.
Well, that's one of the statements of harmless error, but as you know, this court has gone back and forth several times in terms of exactly how to define the idea of harmless error.
And I'm aware of that. I think, though, that the language which the Court of Appeals relies on in furtherance of or in support of its decision is a fair statement of the law as it's defined in that case, and I think it's appropriate standard. I think they also make reference to the test is whether there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction. If it did, reversal and a new trial must result. Again, I think they're citing State v. Dias in furtherance of or in support of that proposition.
Counsel, I want to shift your attention to the third prong.
The
evidence has to be unfairly prejudicial in order to be kept out. Not just prejudicial, because the state, no party would want evidence put in unless it prejudiced the other side, right? That's the whole deal of a trial. And you say it's unfairly prejudicial because learning about the cocaine or supposed cocaine the day before would make the jury think he was a bad person and then they'd want to punish him. But if I take that argument out, it seems it fits every time other acts evidence comes in. They would always think someone was a bad person. How do I look at your argument without such a broad brush?
Well, I think, first of all, you confine the inquiry to the facts at hand here. That is, the charges before this jury related to events within a narrow time frame that occurred October 3, 2005. And then when you juxtapose the proffered evidence, that is, his supposedly having been observed the day before around cocaine and a firearm, especially when you juxtapose those two, you would come to the conclusion that allowing that sort of evidence into this sort of a trial would necessarily invite all sort and manner of unfair prejudice, given the nature of the charges that he faced.
Why is it unfair, though? I mean, that's the part that gets me. I can see that it's prejudicial, but I don't see why it's unfairly prejudicial. I always think of unfairly prejudicial evidence as showing the picture of a murder victim who is just a mess to the jury because they're shocked and they respond with shock. But this isn't the kind of thing that's going to shock anybody.
Well, Justice Rosenberg, when one is mindful of the fact that the principal victim in this case was a Milwaukee police officer who was shot essentially in the line of duty, the nature of those sorts of charges themselves, I think, evoke strong emotion.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the admission of evidence has to be unfairly prejudicial. It's something in the nature of the evidence that's admitted, at least if I understand the test correctly, and I don't understand why showing that there were drugs observed there the day before is unfairly prejudicial, because, focusing on the nature of the evidence.
Sure. Because I think amongst members of the general public, there is a perception that drugs and guns go together, and drugs and gunplay go together. And when one is on trial for gun-related charges, inviting that sort of evidence into that kind of a trial, I think carries with it a strong, strong probability of unfair prejudice, and I think that that's the sort of reasoning that the Court of Appeals applied here.
Well, thank you. Sullivan defines unfair prejudice as follows. Unfair, this is paragraph 62. Unfair prejudice results when the proffered evidence has a tendency to influence the outcome by improper means, or if it appeals to the jury's sympathies, arouses its sense of horror, provokes its instinct to punish, or otherwise causes a jury to base its decision on something other than the established propositions in the case. So you got your choice. Which do you like? Improper means, appeals to the jury's sympathies?
I would say I would focus amongst those choices, provokes its instincts to punish, and invites a jury to base its decision on something other than the established properties.
A bad guy, he has guns and drugs, and he ought to be put away.
Absolutely, that it invites the jury to view the case less as winnowing and sifting through evidence to decide guilt or innocence, and more as a referendum on what we do with people who have guns and who have drugs.
How is that different from any other evidence that's admitted? It's always evidence of a prior bad act, so I'm having a hard time with your analysis.
It requires a determination based on the nature of that evidence as to whether this particular 90404 evidence is of a type that would provoke instinct to punish. In my judgment, in the judgment of the Court of Appeals, this is that type of evidence.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Brennan, is there any way for us to know from the record why there was no cautionary instruction at the second trial, or why there was no objection to the absence of the same?
Justice Gableman, I am not certain why that wasn't done. Clearly, the court, in the passage cited by Justice Abrahamson earlier, had said we are going to have a cautionary instruction. Why it was that wasn't requested or given, it is unclear from the record, and I did not try the second trial.
Could I ask, how many people were in the apartment when the police arrived?
Thank you, Justice Prosser. In that apartment, there was Tony Paiano, the defendant in this case. His cousin was the fellow whose footsteps he had heard running up the stairs, who banged on the door saying, let me in, they're going to shoot me. And Mr. Paiano, Tony Paiano's mother. And Your Honor may recall from the record that there was, as amongst those three people, while the door was being struck, an effort made to initiate a 911 call, which was unsuccessful. Then, after the shot is fired, the three of them retreat to the bathroom, and it's from the bathroom that the 911 call, which actually was received and was recorded, and was the audio of it was received into the record, that call was placed from that area of the apartment. So the short answer is three.
And Mr. Paiano testified?
He did.
Joel testified?
He did, as did the mother. And there were court interpreters used in relation to, I believe, all three, certainly Paiano and his mother, as both of them were their Dominican Republican nationals who have limited command of the English language.
And Joel is alleged to have said, it's not me, It's not me. They are confusing me with someone. Who said that? Did he say that, or did...
The testimony that was received into evidence was that when the police first approached Joelle and Tony Piano's father, who were out in front of the apartment building, they approached Joelle, referring to him as Rico. Rico. And when he ran up into the apartment and banged on the door and said, "Let me in," what he was saying is, "They're calling me Rico. They have me mistaken for someone else."
Is there a dispute about whether Rico and Tony are the same person?
Absolutely. Yes, there was. The question was posed to him whether he, at any point in his life, had ever used any form of the name Rico, and his testimony was no. There were questions posed to family members as to whether they knew him as Rico, had ever heard him referred to as Rico, and uniformly their answers were no.
Did Mr. Kojis testify that Tony Piano was the person he was with the day before?
Yes.
Since we're talking about background, I'm just curious. They retreat to the bathroom. Do the police then come into the home?
That's correct.
Did they know they were the police at that point? Was there any issue regarding that? Because, you know, they have a gun. They're using it in self-defense. And the gun's in the toilet. So they didn't feel any compunction to defend themselves when they put it in the toilet because they abandoned the gun. So I'm just trying to figure that out as to...
Sure. The chronology, Justice Ziegler, as best I understood it, as it was received in the second trial, is the shot is fired. The three of them retreat to the bathroom. The police are ultimately successful in defeating the door lock, getting into the apartment, at which point there are, and this can be heard on the 911 transcription of the 911 audio, they're clearly shouting, "Police, police, police." The three of them, Tony Piano, his cousin Joelle, and Tony's mother, come out of the bathroom and then are laying on the floor and arrested.
Okay. I would like to return to the Court of Appeals opinion, and I'm focusing on paragraphs 24 and 25 with regard to their relevancy determination. Previously in the discussion, the quote that you said came from, I think, your brief. In paragraph 24, the Court of Appeals indicates that we agree with Piano that the alleged presence of cocaine at the residence the day before the shooting, quote, no more supports the proposition that he thus believed that the men attempting to break down the door were the police than it does that Piano believed they were hoodlums seeking to harm his mother, his cousins, and steal the cocaine. And I guess when I first read that, I thought that maybe the Court of Appeals was doing a balancing, which, you know, doesn't make more probable one over the other, because they compared, or they had juxtaposed one to the other. I'm not sure that that's correct. Maybe a better interpretation is that it supports neither as opposed to one over the other. Then paragraph 25, the Court of Appeals says, okay, here's the issue. The issue is whether Piano legitimately believed he was being attacked by non-police officers and fired the shot in self-defense. The Court of Appeals, in paragraph 25, as I interpret it, says that as a matter of law, that the testimony was not relevant to this determination, and therefore the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion. I look at 90401 and the definition of relevancy. And as your opposing counsel noted earlier in questioning, that the statute provides that the action makes more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. So that's the comparison, not one to the other, obviously, but does it make more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence? Explain to me why having the informant testify that, yeah, I was there the other day, there was a bunch of bagged packages of cocaine along with large chunks. In other words, so there was cocaine there, and he told the police that. Why that doesn't make more probable or less probable the relevant issue, whether Payano legitimately believed he was being attacked by non-police officers?
Well, I would explain it this way, Your Honor, in the form of a question, and that question would be, what about Cogis's having observed the firearm and the cocaine the previous day makes it more or less probable that Tony Payano's belief he was being attacked was reasonable? I don't see any connection whatsoever.
What about if you were a person engaging in behavior, which might go to the issue of unfair prejudice too, by the way, the balancing test. But if you were engaging in a situation where you had a gun and you were bagging up cocaine, and there were a bunch of bagged packages of cocaine along with large chunks, that description given in the testimony isn't just a little bit, it sounds like a bunch of bags and large chunks. So if I were a guy, I were in his shoes, I would think that, ooh, I'm engaging in illegal activity, and I'd always be on the watch out. I'd always have of police. I would always have this pall over me, so to speak, being concerned that in every turn, I better watch out. So why, you know, that's not strong evidence maybe, but why doesn't it make it more or less probable than it would be without the evidence? It puts the police at least into the scene.
I think that inference is attenuated kind of beyond reasonable limits. Had there been some evidence or testimony that Payano suspected Cogis was an operative, an informant, or somehow connected with law enforcement, then I think there would be a sufficient nexus such that that might be a reasonable inference. There was no such testimony or evidence, therefore I don't see that as being a reasonable inference. And I see that my time is out, but I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Ms. Larson, you have a few minutes in rebuttal.
On rebuttal, the state would like to focus on the prejudice issue. It's something I didn't address fully in my argument. As a number of you have already noted under Sullivan, the danger is the ultimate inference of propensity. It's not the intermediate inference that he was a bad guy. So the prejudice, the danger is that the jury infers from the other evidence, the item of evidence, that he was a drug dealer, the intermediate inference. And because he was a drug dealer, he was of such character that he necessarily committed the crime. So that's the ultimate inference, that his conduct was in conformity with his bad character on the charged occasion. Here we don't have that ultimate inference because it was never disputed that he shot Officer Lutz. The issue was why. Why did he do it? And that goes to motive. And the statute permits evidence, other ex evidence, if the relevance does not hinge on propensity. And that's the what we have here. He already conceded it. So as Professor Wright talks about in the Federal Evidence Treatise, if the line of proof from the other act to the issue can be completed without the propensity inference, it's admissible even though the other act would also permit an inference as to his character. And I think that's what we have here. And going to Justice Bradley's idea of common sense, I think here what we're talking about is this sort of psychological relevance about, it might not be logical that there's this nexus between his other act and that he knew that it was a search warrant. But I think in his had he had some inkling, or the evidence makes it more likely than without the evidence, that he would know that the police were executing the search warrant on that day, the day after that he was packaging the drugs.
I'm mindful that someone's common sense may not be common and not be sense, and so I'm careful of that. Why, if I'm going to expose my common sense, then let me do that here. And it is, hey, if I'm sitting on a jury, and it's not totally clear to me what came down, but what is clear to me is this guy's a drug dealer. I mean, this is not just a little bit of stuff being testified to. As I said earlier, this is a bunch of bagged packages of cocaine along with large chunks. And he was testifying that that's what was at the kitchen table and what he was doing. He was handling the stuff and moving the bags around, and then he'd stop and go bag some more. I mean, this was an enterprise. This wasn't just a deviation. That's heavy testimony to me. That says to me, this guy's a bad guy. This guy's a drug dealer. This guy's a drug dealer, and what's he doing dealing drugs? That's what it says to me. And it says to me, and then you got a police officer who is a frontline person who's there to protect our safety. And so I'm comparing, I don't know exactly what went on, but I'm comparing, and the whole 911 call. Why is this guy making a 911 call to police? I never quite do figure that out. But, I mean, why would he be doing that if he really thought that there were police there? He was tattling on them? You know, hey, I want you to know. You know, so, I mean, none of that makes sense. So if I don't know what's going on, but I can compare, a law enforcement officer was injured. He's injured there protecting my safety. And you're dealing with a guy who's heavy in drugs. What do you do? That's my common sense, and maybe that's unfair prejudice.
Well, you have to go back to the original Witte factors, and I think they're discussed in some of the cases that I've mentioned in my brief, but number one is the overstrong tendency of the evidence to believe that he's guilty of the charge merely because he's a person likely to do the acts. And as I just mentioned, here we know he did the act. That's not disputed. He shot the officer, but we're only assessing his motive, and he put his motive at issue. So that's part of the prejudice calculus here. This court talked about that in Fishnick. The need for the evidence makes it, the probative value increases, and I think the Court of Appeals doesn't recognize that because he put it at issue. The whole case was about his state of mind, and there's no other way for the state to prove that without introducing this evidence. And another one of the witty dangers that we talk about is the tendency to condemn the defendant, not because he's guilty, but because he escaped punishment. Well, we know from the other act, and we know here that he's not being charged with the other act because the prosecutors made that clear. And also the injustice of attacking someone who's not prepared to demonstrate that the other act's evidence is true. Well, here, he was prepared because he knew about it, and he had the opportunity to discredit the confidential informant, and he had prepared all of that from the first trial. It was not a surprise. So it would actually be an injustice to disallow the state to meet its burden in showing that Payano's self-defense motive was actually a lie. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson, and thank you, Mr. Brennan, for yet another other acts evidence case, somewhat slightly different fact situation. And a review of State v. Sullivan. That concludes our argument 078P 1042 CR State v. Payano. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case.